You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's programme.
We come to ponder a terrible force unleashed in the not-so-distant past. We come to mourn the dead.
President Barack Obama has become the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima. He didn't say sorry, but is it ever expedient for a leader to apologize for past wrongs? Also coming up.
Between 80 and 83, Tony and I were both looking for seats, and there was a time for about 6 to 9 months when Tony was the candidate's husband. It's not easy being the spouse of a candidate, even less so being the spouse of an MP or a minister.
We'll be looking ahead to next week's Globalist, on which we will be discussing the other halves of some of the world's most famous leaders. We'll also look at what has gone wrong in Venezuela and how much worse it might still get, and suggest some summer reading. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker and Monocle's Business Editor Matt Alagaya. Welcome both. We will start with this.
Mere words cannot give voice to such suffering, but we have a shared responsibility to look directly into the eye of history and ask what we must do differently to curb such suffering again. Among those nations like my own that hold nuclear stockpiles, we must have the courage to escape the logic of fear and pursue a world without them.
Just short of 71 years since one of his predecessors approved the order to destroy the city, Barack Obama has become the first serving president of the United States to visit Hiroshima. His speech dwelt not on the morality of Harry Truman's decision in 1945, but on the folly of war between advanced nations since. It was, in part, the probably inevitable pro forma wish for a world free of nuclear weapons, but it was mostly an encouragement to the world to seek non-violent means of resolving conflict. Ed, Barack Obama obviously didn't have to go to Hiroshima. This was not an inevitability. He's running out the clock on his second term. He's president of the United States. He can go where he likes. Why did he?
Well, I think that you partially answered it in the fact that he is nearing the end of his last term in office, and he kind of can do what he wants. So, you know, he doesn't mind so much about making big statements. I think also, apparently, this has been some 6 years in the planning. It was mooted that long ago. So I think it was...
you can imagine the diplomatic negotiations would have been... this would have been a test for the protocol officers and speechwriters, etc., etc.
Indeed. I think it's, you know, we've seen over the years that Barack Obama is very good at this. He's very good at looking serious. He's big on symbolism. He's big on, you know, going and laying the wreath and, you know, telling that he avoided making apology, but wanted to go there and be that first sitting U.S. president to be in Hiroshima nonetheless.
I think it's interesting as well. I was just going to say, I think it's interesting that, you said that he's coming to the end of his time in office. He's also looking at his legacy a bit here. You know, in 2008, he talked about nuclear disarmament as one of his, you know, key policies in the foreign affairs field. And he's clearly failed in that. And I think, you know, when you get towards the end of your second term, he's probably thinking about what his legacy is and what the things that he said when he first went into office. And this has kind of lent weight, I think, to his calls for nuclear disarmament.
There was inevitably some chatter before the speech when the visit was announced about whether or not he would even make anything resembling an apology for the bombing of Hiroshima and obviously Nagasaki. He didn't, and I don't think there was ever any meaningful chance that he was going to, because that would have said basically, "I'm sorry for winning the Second World War." Which was always a fairly unlikely thing for a US president to utter. Ed, should he have, or did he say just about the right amount?
It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, how do you decide when apology should be made by a head of state? You know, one can argue in your homeland it worked for Kevin Rudd, but perhaps it came too late.
Well, it worked for Kevin Rudd. Whether or not it actually worked for the people to whom he was apologising is a different question entirely.
Indeed. But then, you know, this is, and I doubt it's never really easy, is it? But it's such a complex situation because you have You know, you have powers like China and South Korea who don't want the US to make any sort of apology because of atrocities committed by Japan during the Second World War. So I think, you know, as well as not wanting, I'm sure, to show any sort of US weakness by apologizing, he also had to bear in mind the other powers that are at play in this issue.
It's a relatively modern craze, Matt, the historical apology. It probably dates back in the modern era to Willy Brandt's, I think, entirely noble gesture at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial in 1970, which he spontaneously knelt before in a gesture of abasement for what Germany had done there during World War II. Are they actually of any genuine value? There was an interesting statistics I read that they had polled Hiroshima survivors. 80% of them said they saw no need at all for an apology.
And I think you mentioned it earlier, you know, that Kevin Rudd, it wasn't that useful for the people who he was actually apologising to. And I think that touches on something very interesting. I think apologies are kind of cheap, you know, they're easy to do. And actually, it's the actions and what you do after that matters more. So I think Willy Brandt, as you say, that was kind of a historic moment. But then I think it's been backed up, you know, with payments to Israel if from Germany for many, many years and things like that. So I think it's actually more about the actions than the apologies themselves. I mean, I know the apology that David Cameron said to for slavery. So he apologized for Britain's slavery. You know, I think that again, it didn't really. It was just words. I think it means. It has to mean more if you do something. You actually, you know, your actions speak louder than your words.
I mean, that's. I remember that one struck me as a strange gesture at the time because I don't think anybody assumed that either David Cameron or modern Britain was in favor of it.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
And they are odd.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said as well for, you know, when people aren't even, you know, the people who were there at the time aren't even alive anymore. So Barack Obama wasn't born when this happened. So I think it would have been strange for people to ask him to apologise. And I think, you know, the slavery apology was similar to that. You know, I think it means less that in that sense. Whereas something like F.W. de Klerk in South Africa or Willy Brandt, I think because it was in living memory so much that I think it mattered more then.
Ed, is there something that consumes our imaginations, particularly about the atomic bombings? I mean, this is a statement of fact, not any kind of glib dismissal. Worse things did happen in World War II. Many years ago, slightly strangely, I ended up meeting Colonel, as he then was, Brigadier General Paul Tibbets, the pilot of the Enola Gay, who was flogging his autobiography at an air show in Texas. It's actually a really interesting book in which he makes the point that, well, as he puts it himself, I'm paraphrasing him slightly, he says what he did was terrible. He said it, but it was the same sort of terrible as was done by every bomber pilot who flew over Tokyo, over Dresden, over Coventry, over London. He said it's all dropping explosives on civilian cities. It's all terrible. But, you know, he said other pilots dropped hundreds of bombs. I dropped one.
I think it's maybe the point is, you know, the symbolism and imagery of it, the kind of
it's that image, isn't it?
Of it. Yeah. The fact that arguably, you know, 140,000 people were killed in Hiroshima and are, I think, around 70,000 for the second bomb. You know, I think you can arguably say that, you know, those two actions changed the course of history, completely changed the course of the Second World War. We're talking about two bombs. So I think the power, both symbolically and actually physically, that they had is the reason why we kind of fixate on it. If that hadn't happened, arguably it would have taken much longer to win the war.
Okay, well, let's move on now and look at Venezuela. First, however, we will listen to this.
What I found very attractive about him, he wasn't there to get rich like so many people in politics. He was there to do things for ordinary people. I mean, he'd served in the army. I remember him telling me the pain he felt one day when one of his troops had been shot and died in his arms, and he realised that guerrilla war had to be brought to an end. It had to be brought to an end by compromise.
That was the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, waxing in comradely fashion on the subject of the late Hugo Chavez. The Bolivarian Republic, built by El Comandante, appears to be unravelling at an ever-accelerating rate under his successor, Nicolas Maduro. There are now reports that the long queues for Venezuela's dwindling food supplies are beginning to give way to looting mobs. We will be featuring Venezuela in an extended edition of the Foreign Desk tomorrow. Ed, first of all, it's a hypothetical question, but had Chavez lived, would things have gotten this bad? Is there whatever follies there were in his regime, have they been exacerbated by his successor?
Well, I think things were starting to unravel towards the latter half of his presidency. I mean, at the beginning, he represented a break with the past, a break with the elites that had traditionally controlled Venezuela. You know, oil prices were high. The economy was booming on the back of this. And he did do some great things for the country in terms of social policies. I think that, you know, what wouldn't have changed is the global price of oil. So it's hard to see that there wouldn't have been an economic problem in Venezuela had he continued to live. I think what's certainly true is that Maduro doesn't have the charisma. I mean, we've seen in the past, he's essentially tried to puppet the way Chavez talks. You know, he's waxed lyrical. He's compared, you know, a little bird to being Chavez. You know, he just seems a bit lost. All he's trying to do is mimic the gestures and the speech of Chavez. So I think a lot of people have seen that he's essentially a weak leader and he's lost out as a result of that. So we might not have seen such a polarized country. We might not have seen the losses for the ruling party in the National Assembly had Chavez stayed alive, because he managed, you know, he had such a broad appeal, certainly with some of the poorest parts of Venezuelan society. But having said all of that, you know, we still would have seen a lot of the economic problems that we're seeing today in Venezuela, because it is such a mono economy that is so reliant on its exports of oil.
Matt, we did hear at the top of this item from this city's former mayor, and it was good to hear him going a solid 20 seconds without mentioning Hitler there, given his recent form. He was, of course, just one of many prominent identities on the European left who was extraordinarily supportive of Hugo Chavez and all he stood for. In fact, there was a point at which I think he tried to get London as a separate entity to sort of develop its own foreign policy towards Venezuela, which was an enduring peculiarity. What was it about Chavez that sort of attracted so much of the European left, among them the current leadership of the Labour Party in this country? Was it just the red beret and his willingness to call the United States names?
I think so. It was funny. Yeah, I think they were kind of won over by, you know, obviously his showmanship and his populism at the same time. I mean, you mentioned there that he wanted to turn London into its own state. Ken Livingstone wanted Venezuelan oil for London's buses. You know, he wanted to make that a deal. And there was always this kind of slightly shady side of it. And there were always, you know, concerns by some people that these deals weren't 100% above board. And I think they were just won over by the fact that, yes, exactly, that he believed in similar things to them on foreign policy. Like, you know, Ken Livingstone said that Bush was the most dangerous person in the world, or to some words to that effect. And I think they agreed on several things that meant that they were kind of won over by him.
He was an amazing orator. I mean, it can't be denied.
So we're clear, this is Hugo Chavez we're talking about, not Ken Livingstone.
Yeah.
Or Bush.
Hugo Chavez. And certainly not Bush. I just remember that there's that famous 2006 United Nations speech where Chavez gets up and, you know, compares, talking about George W. Bush, he compares him to the devil and says it still smells of sulfur. And it's kind of interesting to see the delegates sitting there, because they're kind of giggling like school children. He had that, you know, he was funny. He was an incredible speaker, and at times he was inspiring. So I think, yes, some leaders got swept up in the romanticism of it all. And you've seen the same in Cuba with Che Guevara, exactly the same thing.
Well, and indeed with Fidel Castro, who is or was a great showman.
Yeah, and people gloss over the fact that, you know, in the case of Cuba, these people kill people, that they're still romanticized by the left and continue to be.
Returning to Venezuela's current state, Matt, as Ed pointed out, for a country reliant on oil, the collapse in global oil prices has presented it with no end of difficulties. But other oil-reliant countries are not seeing people queuing round the block for sugar. Is this really an excuse?
I don't know. I think very few countries in the world are as reliant on oil as Venezuela is. 95% of its export revenues come from oil, which is just an astonishing figure. So when oil goes down to about $35 a barrel, which it is now, and you know, you can see how devastating that could be. And there's no signs of it really getting any better with OPEC obviously, you know, continuing to pump oil out the ground. So it doesn't look very good. And I think, to be honest, that's the main reason. You know, that is why this is happening. it's so reliant on oil. And I think, you know, the economy was mismanaged for many, many years as well. When the going was good, as Ed said, when oil prices were high, they didn't really diversify the economy.
They don't appear to have had the meeting about, chaps, what do we do if for some reason the global oil price goes completely in the dumper?
Completely. And that happened under Chavez as well as under Maduro.
But also, I mean, it's less extreme in other countries than South America, but, you know, a lot of South American nations are reliant on commodities, soya, for example. A lot of them rode the crest of high soya prices, you know, countries like China buying a vast amount. When those prices went down, those economies suffered. So, you know, it's the same but less extreme in other nations, and there doesn't always seem to be a backup plan for when it starts to go wrong. And certainly in Venezuela, there is no backup plan whatsoever. And I think, you know, we've seen looting recently. No food on shelves is becoming, you know, something that's commonplace. Coca-Cola isn't producing their drinks in the country anymore. Not necessarily a bad thing, due to a lack of sugar. Empresa Pola, one of the biggest private companies in the country, is shutting down its beer production because it can't
buy. Possibly more serious.
So, you know, we'll have to see what happens, but I don't think it's going to get any better in the short run.
But we are looking now, I think, at a situation summed up by that quotation, which is variously attributed, but I think it was probably Alfred Lewis, that there are only, you know, basically nine missed meals between mankind and anarchy. Is Venezuela reaching that point? And if you are Nicolas Maduro, which I'm not saying is a fate I would wish on you presently, but does he have a good move left? If you are currently occupying that office, you're president of Venezuela, is there actually anything you can do at this point, other than just getting as much gold as you can onto a private plane and hitting the skies?
And heading for some Caribbean island. It's hard to know what plan he has up his sleeve. You know, Enrique Capriles is spearheading a campaign to try and get him to step down. There's over 1.8 million signatories. It's hard to know what's going to happen and if he's actually going to complete this term. Or if he'll be toppled before 2019. I have a feeling he might be, but we'll have to see what happens.
We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Ed Stocker and Matt Allagaier. Coming up next, your summer reading guide and the role of the political spouse. But first, this.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ed Stocker and Matt Allagaier. Now, this year's iteration of the Hay Festival is underway. As of yesterday, the great literary festival in the Brecon Beacons. And with that in mind, Matt has a few suggestions for your summer reading.
Absolutely. I think in my capacity as the presenter of the Arts Review, the Books Review every week, quite a lot of titles come across my desk. And I thought I'd just pick out some of the highlights from the last few months, really. So I think top of the list for fiction is The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry, which only came out this week. It's a kind of interesting historical fiction. It's set in the 19th century and is all about this woman called Cora Seaborn, whose husband dies. And she moves to Essex with her son. And what sort of transpires from there is she meets the vicar of a parish in Aldwinter, and it transpires that there's a sort of mythical Essex serpent which is rumoured to be going around the estuary lands and killing people. And what basically happens is Cora and this vicar, his name is William Ransom, they basically start on this kind of moral journey, talking about faith and religion and atheism. I mean, she's basically a naturalist and has and is arguing for most of the book with this religious man. So that's your fiction, I think.
Okay. What else have you got in the heap?
Got a couple of non-fiction pieces here. Paul McCartney, the biography, which is written by Philip Norman, came out on the 5th of May. This is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. This is interesting because I think it slightly challenges the idea that... I think a lot of people write books about the Beatles and say that John Lennon was the cool, outrageous one with all of the talent, and Paul McCartney was just nice and wrote little ditties.
See that generalisation's always annoyed me, so I can't begin to imagine how much it annoys Paul McCartney.
Well, exactly.
But more to the point, what is there about Paul McCartney that we don't already know at this point? He's one of the most famous men on earth and has been for more than half a century.
Well, what's interesting is this book goes to 850 pages, so it is completely unbelievably in depth about his life. And I think there's just little bits that people probably haven't heard before. You know, part of their time in Hamburg, Philip Norman talks about the fact that in Hamburg it was more McCartney than Lennon who was actually kind of leading things and leading the creative side. And there's a very kind of interesting part of the Beatles' life which people often forget, which is when Paul McCartney was living in London and being quite kind of bohemian, and John Lennon was living on a golf course. And it's quite an interesting moment where you realise, okay, actually, we need to kind of redress the balance when it comes to that. We have a couple of other interesting books. I think there's another non-fiction here that I'd like to talk about, which is called A Life Discarded. This is by Alexander Masters, and this is quite amazing. Basically, Alexander Masters is a writer based in Cambridge, and he, some friends of his, found a skip full of diaries, full of 150 volumes of diaries. They were kind of covered in mould, and he sort of sat on them for a while, not literally, but he sat on them for a couple of years, and then decided to open them, and he opened them randomly throughout the next year.
This is a literal, real thing. This isn't a literary device like the Flashman papers or something. This is literally a bunch of diaries found in a skip.
So a lot of people thought it was a hoax, but no, it is in fact real. And he did find 148 diaries, which people think that this might be the most prolific diary writer of all time. But A Life Discarded is effectively his discovery of this person. So for the first 20 pages or so, he doesn't know if it's a man or a woman, then he doesn't know her name, and gradually you kind of build up a picture, but it's all through Alexander Masters' eyes, so it's quite a fascinating read. I would really recommend that one.
That sounds amazing. Well, finally tonight, we will move on to that discussion of political spouses. To get us in the mood, there's this.
Then when we got in the White House, all the things that I'd always done suddenly became wonderful. And I was so happy for Jack, especially now that it was only 3 years together, that he could be proud of me then. So those were our happiest years.
Between 80 and 83, Tony and I were both looking for seats, and there was a time for about 6 to 9 months when Tony was the candidate's husband. It's not easy being the spouse of a candidate, even less so being the spouse of an MP or a minister.
When we met 45 years ago, we fell in love. I thought she was the most amazing person because everything she touched, she made better.
Yes, I made mistakes. I don't think I did any harm to Margaret. You know, the longer you keep your mouth shut, the safer you are.
Jackie Kennedy, Cherie Blair, Bill Clinton and Dennis Thatcher. You should be able to work out which was which. All next week on The Globalist, we will be looking at political wives and husbands. It's a role far more scrutinised than it once was, but still not entirely defined. This is a conundrum that will be considered more and more as the US presidential election gets properly underway and White House protocol officers have to figure out how to address a former president who might also be their first male presidential spouse. Ed, looking ahead to this presidential campaign, we have, well, possibly two of the strangest candidates in some respects we've had, but sort of two of the least usual potential presidential spouses, as in one is a sort of Eastern European model who never appears to speak, and the other actually used to be president himself.
Indeed, and in the case of Bill Clinton, it's interesting because, you know, as is often the case, the spouse needs to stay behind the scenes, not be too visible. But actually, you know, Bill Clinton...
Not Bill Clinton's strong suit.
No, but he's managing it, sort of. I mean, he's had a pretty packed itinerary in the last few months, and his job, it seems at the moment, is to keep a fairly low profile and not overshadow his wife too much, as long as he doesn't start wagging his finger at speeches when Black Lives Matter members disrupt one of his talks. But it'll be interesting to see how that develops, and if Hillary becomes president, whether he'll have any sort of role.
Yeah. I mean, if you are running for president and you are Hillary Clinton, Matt, how difficult is it is managing the fact of Bill Clinton? Because on the one hand, he is a, whatever else other reservations you may have reasonably have about him, he's a fantastic speaker. He's a great campaigner. He's a largely well-regarded former president. But of course, if you make too much of him, you end up just having people wish he was running instead of you.
Completely, and I think that's the balancing act for her, because she's in many ways kind of tried to distance herself a little bit from Bill, but obviously you have to use that. That is an immense asset in her back pocket, the fact that he was so well loved by many Democrats.
But I think it's also a bit of a thorn, because this election cycle is unique in the sense that there's such a distrust of the establishment, and no one can be more establishment than the combination of Bill and Hillary Clinton. So whether that's going to come back to bite her when it actually comes to the general election in November, we'll have to see. Everyone wrote off Trump, and he seems to be closing and closing. And according to some polls, he's now even ahead. I think that's largely because people are disenchanted with politics in the US, just like we saw with that almost upset in Austria. It's the same problem.
I mean, Ed, you lived under a not dissimilar arrangement in Argentina.
It was pretty different.
Well, but it was still the senior office in the land being traded between a married couple.
I mean that was a kind of bizarre setup. Nestor Kirchner deciding to step down after his first term and put his wife forward as a candidate. But when she subsequently won, it was very obvious that he was still pulling the strings. I guess the thought was that they were going to alternate and kind of establish an almost Putin-esque grip on power. He actually died of a heart attack in 2010 before we could see if that was actually going to happen.
I mean, Matt, how has the role evolved? Because obviously, traditionally, political spouses have mostly been female, and then certainly until recently, they were regarded as mostly decorative. Have we yet entirely figured out what it is they're supposed to do?
That's interesting. I mean, no, I think it is really in flux, because I think someone like Michelle Obama has completely changed the role in many ways. She's been very, very present, very visible. I think she's used that platform and that profile to push certain policies. Women's rights is something that she's really pushed for, and it's quite unusual. But I think what they've sensibly done is, she has actually better approval rating. A lot of spouses have better approval ratings than their husbands or wives, and I think she's one of them. I think Michelle actually does have better approval ratings, which means that she can use that platform to, in subtle ways. Obviously, you can't be actually pushing policy, but in subtle ways to use that to change the debate.
I mean, what do you think, Ed? Should they be entitled to a role because they've married somebody who got elected, or should they be mindful of the fact that nobody actually voted for him, voted for them, rather? I say for him because I was about to mention the example of Chancellor Angela Merkel's completely anonymous husband, who I could have sat next to on the tube on the way here without knowing about it.
Who's at the G7 summit? For the first, accompanying his wife for the first time.
Yeah, apparently he quite fancied going to Japan, but other than that,
he wanted to try the food.
Yeah,
or something.
He stays home.
I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? We've seen such different models. You're just talking about Michelle Obama. If you compare that with, say, Laura Bush, who was pretty invisible, I think each one of those spouses does kind of potentially make it, make the role their own. Hillary Clinton had her own office, I think, the first spouse to have that. I think, largely it's about making sure you don't make any big slip-up, which involves keeping fairly quiet. You don't want to get too involved in politics because you don't want to annoy your husband or wife who's in power.
Indeed not. Ed Stocker and Matt Allagher, thank you for joining us here at Midori House. You can hear our series on political spouses all next week on The Globalist. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Faith Barker. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next at 1900 hours. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'll be your host for that as well. But for now, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.